AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Katie Rich, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, and I'm here with our whole crew as we ramp ourselves up for this exciting time of year. I'm here with our chief critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello.
Our digital director, Mike Hogan.
Hey.
And our senior writer, Joanna Robinson.
Hi, Katie.
So as far as I know, Richard's bag and cowboy hat are packed, and Mike's too. You're both heading off to the mountains of Telluride. You're going to come back changed people and maybe just open a ranch and just watch movies forever, which sounds pretty good.
It's like a billion degrees in New York, and I was looking in my closet today, looking at the flannel shirts, just going, I can't wait.
It's going to be
be able to wear this.
It's going to be good.
But what you wear on the plane is the hard part. Like, are you going to wear shorts to the airport? It's a tough call.
No shorts on the plane.
Is that le faux pas?
I think so. Well, it'll be cold. It's air conditioned.
Oh, that's true, too. Yeah.
Well, welcome to Travel Talk, where we talk about what we wear for airports. So anyway, we're going to talk about what's to come at Telluride and a little bit about Toronto and the piece that Richard wrote kind of summarizing all of this. And then later in the episode, we're going to share an interview that Mike did with Vanity Fair contributing writer Monica Lewinsky and Greg Hahn of BBDO, the advertising agency. They are Emmy nominees, which I think maybe a lot of people didn't know. And Mike, you've known Monica for a long time, so we'll talk more about that conversation you guys had later on.
Yes, it was fun.
First, Richard, let's just turn to start with the piece that you wrote just about what is exciting about fall festival season. As you noted, like there's you listed 28 movies. They're all going to premiere in the next 2 weeks, which is a little overwhelming. How did you go about narrowing this down, and how overwhelming was it to look at all of this?
I mean, it's a lot, but if you go so when this episode gets posted, Venice will be a day into the festival, and then Telluride is this coming weekend, and then Toronto. So if you break it down in a sort of like almost like, you know, just by its schedule, then it becomes a little bit more manageable. But I think that, like, in writing about it as a sort of preview of the whole festival season, you know, you want to pick out what you think are like the big front runners. And I think, you know, so I took some gambles on that, and I could be proven massively wrong, who knows. But I think that the two biggest ones that I, or the three biggest ones that I focused on were First Man, the Damien Chazelle movie, Barry Jenkins' new movie, If Beale Street Could Talk. So they're squaring off against each other again, you know, 2 years after the Moonlight La La Land wars. And then Widows, the Steve McQueen movie that's maybe more commercial than an Oscar play, but still, you know, it's Steve McQueen, it's Viola Davis. Like, we can't discount it from any kind of awards conversation.
Yeah, what's interesting is the three of them that you point out as kind of like recent like Oscar winners, whether Best Director or Best Picture, but there's Alfonso Cuarón lurking around there. We're getting a ton of people who have won major Oscars for filmmaking in the last couple of years, all in the mix this year, which makes it feel, even though it's all kind of mysterious because no one's seen anything and we don't have any competitors for the first half of the year, there's a bunch of heavy hitters like right on the horizon.
Yeah, I mean, Roma, the Alfonso Cuarón movie, which is this black and white epic set in the 1970s Mexico City that I believe is very autobiographical for Cuarón, like that is obviously an event. That's playing all three. That's going to be at premiere at Venice. It's going to pass through Telluride, and it's going to go to Toronto, which is an interesting thing. I mean, it's shot on 70mm. It's getting this huge festival push, but it's a Netflix movie. And so, as ever, as we've talked about for the past couple of years, like watching how Netflix tries, Ted Sarandos in particular, tries to figure out an awards campaign. They've hired now specific publicists for awards season. They're really putting a push behind it. And Roma seems to be their biggest play. They also have Paul Greengrass's movie, 22 July, about the 2011 terrorist attacks in Norway. So maybe this actually is the year when Netflix, I mean, they had Mudbound, but like,
they've got serious awards consultant firepower ready for on behalf of these two films. And I think I've heard a seriously good buzz about Roma. And the other one I've heard seriously good buzz about from people who've actually seen movies is Yorgos Lanthimos' The Favourite. That people are kind of blown away by it, because I think the other movies are amazing, but they're so weird and dark. I mean, we've discussed The Lobster, etc. But like this one, somebody else wrote it. He just came in and did his kind of crazy thing on it. It's a royal story, right? And Olivia Colman is apparently incredible in it. And so that is a movie. I mean, I'm wondering if McQueen, Chazelle, and Jenkins may... I'm curious to see these movies, but I'm wondering if these may not quite live up to the understandable hope that we have given the other things that those directors have produced. And I think some of these other things may jump out. And it sounds like Roma, I mean, it certainly has a lot of prestige indicators, you know, built into it, starting with the black and whiteness of it all and the kind of relevance of the topic that it's about migrants, you know, actually living their lives in this psychopathic environment that we live in. So I think it's really interesting. I mean, I'm going into these festivals with three categories in mind, like the movies that are hyped that are going to die when people see them, the movies that no one's even thinking about, that are going to jump into the conversation.
This year's I, Tonya, to
yes,
example.
Sure. Or even, remember Lady Bird last year, Katie, you and I were sitting, yeah. It was 9 a.m., we're sitting with giant coffees, I had a little bit of a hangover, and we're just like weeping. I'm weeping, yeah, into my Starbucks, and I'm like, this movie is going to go places.
Well, and that was something that I don't think was on my radar at all until Telluride, when it showed up there and people came out of that raving. So Telluride can, yes, often be an interesting spot for you to be like, I didn't know they had a movie.
Yeah, and then the third category are the ones that come in with hype and just get a giant bounce and are like, you know, at, yeah, the rim of Best Picture winning for the rest of the season. So it'll be fun to see which ones are which.
I'm obviously just going off of trailers. I mean, general hype and then trailers that I've watched. And I have to say that, like, you know, I'm ready and willing to be proven wrong. But every time I watch the First Man trailer, I'm just like deeply uninterested. And I am a Damien Chazelle fan. And I don't know what it is. I'm not normally anti-astronaut movie, but there's something like... However, that trailer is cut is not getting me. And I was holding off on watching the If Beale Street Could Talk trailer because I just love Moonlight so much and I am worried that this won't meet my expectations. But I was reading Richard's great roundup of these films on the website this morning and I was like, okay, I finally have to watch it. And I was just holding my breath the whole movie, the whole trailer, just in like sort of delight and awe of how it's cut. And so... I gotta say, like, Jenkins, I'm still on the hype train. Chazelle, I'm like, I don't know. It's not, maybe I need more music from Damien Chazelle and less fewer astronauts.
Well, is First Man at Venice, or do we think it'll be at Telluride, or is the Toronto Cinesphere premiere where we're going to see this for the first time? Richard, do you know?
No, yeah, First Man is going to be at all three.
Oh, okay. So, all right. I was just thinking of that. The big IMAX screening at Toronto is so splashy that it's interesting that they're selling it so hard that way.
Well, the interesting thing about First Man, well, there's a lot of interesting things about it, but like, this is Universal that's putting this out. This is a big studio movie, and so yeah, they're giving it the kind of the real rollout. And not only are they doing it in IMAX in Toronto, but at IMAX screenings of various movies. I think Mission Impossible was one this summer. They would do a special 4-minute presentation of First Man, where they would, I think they showed like the moonwalk or whatever, like the moon landing basically scene.
Did they show the musical number during the space shuttle parking traffic?
That's right.
Jam?
That's exactly
in
right.
Houston?
Yeah. Great. Few people know that in the 60s there were so many space shuttles that there were traffic jams.
And Ryan Gosling lands on the moon and moonwalks, and there's a whole Michael Jackson
Emma Stone
theme.
Sings about it's Paris great. For some reason. But I think that, Joanna, going what you know, your sort of initial like hesitance about this movie, like for me it's a little bit not disappointing, but sort of like, eh, that like after Chazelle had these two huge buzzy breakout films, won an Oscar as a director, then kind of goes to like a studio movie about NASA in the 60s, which is like some baby boomer shit.
Youngest ever best director winner, right?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
So why not do 80s or 90s nostalgia, dude?
Or something. I mean, just something that isn't like, you know, I mentioned in the piece that like stuff about NASA tends to do very well at the Academy. The Right Stuff, Apollo 13, Hidden Figures, like all Best Picture nominees. It's a very safe play from him. Not that I think he made a movie to win Oscars, but like, yeah, it just feels like, oh, that could have been something else. And whereas I think with Barry Jenkinson's case, like him following up Moonlight, which that's a really tricky follow up because that movie was like seismic. Like that was, yeah, such a big thing. And no one, you know, knew who he was really. With a James Baldwin adaptation, that feels like an evolution in a way, in an interesting way.
Although, weren't they both? Wasn't he was working on it already? Wasn't he when Moonlight came out? I think so.
Yeah.
But still.
Yeah,
yeah.
Still.
Well, I mean, he's on his artistic path, mm-hmm, and you see Damien making this leap over to like more explicitly commercial stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, look, La La Land is the work of someone who aspires to do commercial work, right? I mean, it's like scrappy, but it's a big crowd-pleasing movie. You know, I think that's his heart is there. So,
and I have no problem if you know, anointing a new sort of studio approved, you know, a kind of auteur,
yeah,
like another Christopher Nolan or whatever, mm-hmm, he's you know aiming to be. But you know, I'm curious about it. And I think, Mike, you're right to point out the favorite. I have heard, you know, some people get to see these things before the festivals, and everyone I've talked to who's seen the favorite is like, it's very good.
And even from people who weren't fans necessarily of The Lobster or Killing of the Sacred Deer, as I understand it, like, it's not that it's like weird Lanthimos, it's like really accessible.
I've heard weird accessible, you know, like weird in a fun, like in a fun, I can get on board, not like does the dogdie.com, you know, sort of thing.
Yeah, normal people are enjoying the weirdness of it.
Right. Can we talk about another 2017 Oscar contender that I had a fun time with their trailer this morning, which is whatever it is Viggo Mortensen is doing in The Green Book.
Oh my God, yeah.
He's doing like this hardcore bada bing sort of really big performance. And I can't tell from the trailer, you know, Richard points out in the piece that this is directed by Peter Farrelly. It's a 1960s set sort of buddy road movie with Mahershala Ali and Viggo Mortensen curing racism, I think, with music or something like that. But like the trailer sort of got me and then lost me and then got me again, where I'm just like, I both these actors are so good in everything they do that I can't imagine this is going to be as like preachy and saccharine as I'm afraid it's going to be. But at the same time, I don't know, I'm just curious what you guys think of this and if this is a potential play for Viggo again.
Yeah, I was so sold on everything Viggo was doing in that trailer, and I wasn't expecting it, because you're right, Joanna, the whole like, hey, I'm from Jersey, like it feels like too much, but he's such a good actor that you're like, okay, yeah, he's this guy, why not?
I find it appealing. That trailer weirdly like worked on me, and the Peter Farrelly aspect of it, you know, he's mostly known for these kind of big body comedies with his brother, that I feel like only adds to the appeal in a strange way. It's like, okay, what can he do in this vein? I was most taken by Mahershala Ali in that trailer. He's doing something too. They're both doing very big character-y kind of things. Ali is speaking in this kind of like clipped, sort of very formal cadence, and I don't know. I feel like that one could kind of sneakily. That feels like a front runner for like the Toronto Audience Prize. You know what I mean?
Can I throw out a theory about Mahershala Ali and then also Olivia Colman? Because we saw that teaser for True Detective Season 3 starring Mahershala Ali. And Olivia Colman's also going to be in The Favorite. And then The Crown Season 3, which is going to premiere in December sometime, I assume. So it'll be interesting if you've got these acting Oscar contenders who have incredible work showing on television at the same time. It's like the reverse in orbit. I don't know that we can count on Mahershala Ali winning another Oscar, but who knows? But it could be interesting to watch them kind of go between these different roles and like have week after week show is like, oh no, I'm great. You really want to give me an award.
It's going to be fun because like, you know, those of us who pay attention like have been like clocked Olivia Colman a few years ago,
yeah.
I know. And now this year, like everyone's going to know who she is because of the Favorite and The Crown, like, and it's great because she's the best. She's such a good actress and such a kind of particular presence that I'm really excited for her.
Both royal shows or whatever.
She's playing two queens.
Yes, she's playing two queens. So there's a lot of resonance there.
Two dope queens.
It is two dope queens. But yeah, I think Katie, you're right. It's gonna be very easy for people to sort of for feelings about one performance to bleed into the other. If everyone's watching The Crown.
I don't want to throw cold water on Katie's theory, but The Crown Season 3 isn't back till 2019.
Damn.
Maybe early 2019.
What if it's in February, right? Just in time for voting.
Yeah, maybe early 2019. Oh, I wanted to do my like my usual thing, which is play the smug book reader and talk about three book adaptations that I'm excited about, which is The Hate U Give, The Sisters Brothers, and Beautiful Boy, all three of which I've read. And I think I've already talked before about how I think Beautiful Boy, you know, which is this Steve Carell, Timothy Chalamet addiction based on a true story.
Based on two books, isn't it? Have you read both of the books, Joanna?
Yes, I have.
Wow.
Because the chefs, Nick and David Sheff, are Bay Area people. So I've read the memoirs. And I think what I said before is that I feel like the chefs, because they have spent years on the book talk circuit, like giving presentations about this time in their life and what it meant to them and how they grew from it and all of that sort of stuff, they are going to be huge assets, I think, on the award season circuit, like more so than like even like a Tonya Harding would be or something like that, just because they are well trained at speaking so effectively about this experience. And so I don't mean to sound hugely cynical, but like that, you know, I just can't help but see that as a massive asset for this particular project.
I mean, I may have said this before, and I want to come back, Joanna, to what else you want to say about this, but I just want to throw this out there. There was talk last season in Timothy's camp that he needed to not worry too much, let Gary Oldman like win the Oscar and view it as a walk up to winning this year. I mean, they've seen this as a very serious opportunity for a long time, like before I think the movie was even finished.
Yeah.
So, it'd be interesting.
Yeah. I remember you talking about that, and I love Richard's, like, you know, I've heard Richard say it, I think like four times now, that they need to run Timothée Chalamet in supporting, so much so that I really think we should get Little Gold Men shirts made, like, that should say like run Timmy in supporting or something like that.
Well, because I think they are still debating it. They're trying to figure out like which, yeah, there's kind of two leads in the film, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think something we talked about last year was the Academy's discomfort with giving Oscars to very young men. Like, they'll give it to young women in lead, but not necessarily very young men. And I think they'd be much more comfortable giving Timothée Chalamet a supporting Oscar, you know, with whatever ageism is at play there for younger men.
Well, also, he's had the Call Me By Your Name run, so it's not like he's this new fresh face. I mean, he is, but like he's a known quantity. So if they decide they like him again, it's like, okay, we're not just taking a gamble on some young kid. You're, you know, the future of Hollywood.
I've also heard that the people who have seen The Hate U Give feel like a little mixed on it already. That book was very powerful. Like, has a huge built-in audience, so like I think it'll be massively successful no matter what the actual Oscar chances are for him.
Yeah, it's getting a big like Friday night premiere at Toronto, so you know they're clearly putting some attention on it. You know, it's a big festival for the star of the film, Amanda Stenberg. She's in that, and she's also in When Hands Touch, which is Amma Asante's movie about a biracial girl living in Nazi Germany and falling in love, I believe, with a Nazi soldier played by George McKay. So she's gonna be a presence, Amanda Stenberg, at the festival. Hate U Give is probably the biggest YA book of the last couple of years. Clearly, all eyes are on that. I've heard, again, like you said, Joanna, mixed things about it. But when those movies premiere with those audiences at those big theaters in Toronto and everyone's excited to be there, like, certain things can happen. I'll harken back to my theory of everything when I stumbled out of that. And I was like, that's the best movie ever made. <You know? laughs> And, you know, he did win an Oscar for it. So I don't know. I think that, like, I think stuff that's crowd pleasing and crowd rousing, I guess, like that's a perfect kind of thing for Toronto. So I think Hate U Give will be pretty high on people's you know, register when it premieres.
Well, crowd pleasing means we want to bring up the thing that you saved until the very end of your preview, Richard, which I think is as good a sign as any. It's something being like maybe not the most anticipated, but right up there. A Star Is Born just feels like this massive, yeah, thing waiting for us, and it's going to premiere at Venice on Friday, so we'll know kind of how crowds respond to it really soon. But it's just looking so massive from where we are. I rewatched the trailer, which, Richard, as far as I know, you watched daily, like you and David Sims and Bobby Finger just tweet gifts, yeah, from it as much as possible. And I feel like I'm becoming more and more sold on it just by thinking about it. It just feels huge, right?
Yeah, I mean, who knows, that could be a sort of like confirmation bias thing where like the sort of world that I'm peering in on, like the Bobby Fingers and David Sims of the world, like who are like obsessed with the trailer and the her like song cue and toward the end of it, and Bradley Cooper saying, "I just want to get another look at you." Like, there's a lot about it.
Wow. But, That was very good or done, Richard.
Yeah, it'll be the new Sling Blade. But there was a review of it that like this guy posted, not knowing that there was an embargo. He's a producer. I think he has a podcast that was basically like comparing it to like Cassavetes and like, you know, the sort of like masterpieces of the 70s golden age of cinema. Like, he really went in on this movie like in a positive way, and you know, he's not a critic or whatever, but like this guy loved this movie, and so that gives me reason to hope. And no matter what, I think it's something I said in the thing I wrote, like, if it's a commercial crowd pleaser but a critical failure, or the opposite, or both, or whatever, like, whatever it is, it's going to be something.
Yes.
And I think we're all hungry for something.
Yeah. Are we really buying that this was a mistake, that this was put up? Because the thing I heard before that went up was that Bradley Cooper was showing it to all of his friends in Hollywood but keeping it away from critics, for whatever reason, part maybe just to kind of like, you know, have the maximum impact, but that he was really proud of it, but that it sounded to me like he wanted the industry to get behind it first. And I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist, but I just could imagine like a little bit of a calculated, like, let's have the first review of this come from a filmmaker who gets what I'm trying to do rather than some asshole critic on the internet. I don't know.
I would buy that totally.
Yeah.
I heard out of LA, I heard that like from some people who have seen it or talked to people who have seen it that like you have to either go all in and buy in on what Bradley Cooper's doing, his Sling Blade thing, or you are out in the cold in this movie.
In terms of his performance?
Yeah, just like we were just talking about like Viggo and Mahershala and like big performances, like the voice and the grizzled and like all of the stuff that he's doing. Like Lady Gaga is not the obstacle, that it's like potentially Bradley Cooper that's the obstacle. I'm all in on the trailer. I'm pro A Star Is Born. I'm really here for it. The other thing I've heard is that it is not different in any way demonstrably from the Barbara Streisand film, which like I actually don't know how many like how enduring that film is like I tried to watch that I think like last year and it's like 3 hours long and like I enjoyed it but like I don't know that that's like a film that so many people have seen that they'll be like ugh this is just a retread of Barbara and Kris Kristofferson which is a retread of Judy and like et cetera et cetera.
I would guess that most people are familiar with the title. They're like, oh, that's yes. a thing.
Right.
Like, that's
exactly.
existed before. But beyond that, I don't think that, like, there's an intimate familiarity beyond, like, the realm of, like, gay men in their middle age. Like who are, like, intimately familiar with the Barbara Streisand movie, which is not good.
Like, I guess the last thing I'll say on it is that I don't know how much the Academy class has changed in the last couple years, but like I would comfortably say a couple years ago that the Academy was so enamored of Bradley Cooper that there is no doubt in my mind that they would give him a directing nod for this. Like, do you know what I mean?
He got nominated 3 years in a row
exactly.
as Best Actor, or maybe one was supporting. Anyway, he got nominated 3 years in a
so
row.
So, like, you know, and Mike has talked so many times about, like, the warmth with which, like, awards bodies accept, like, double, triple threats or whatever. So, like, Lady Gaga getting an Oscar for Best Song and Bradley Cooper at least getting nominated for Best Director feels so certain to me. That's... sight unseen, that's how I feel.
Well, that leads us to another movie that will be, I believe, premiering at Telluride, Joel Edgerton's Boy Erased. Oh, another movie directed by an actor, or who was the person who was an actor first.
And starring the actor, at least in some degree.
And so that has, Lucas Hedges is in the lead there, so Timmy and Lucas are back in the mix again this year. And Troy Sivan, who is this young gay pop star, child actor turned YouTuber turned pop star, he has a supporting role in the movie, but also wrote a song for it that I did ask someone who saw it. I said, does it play in the movie? Because that's the new kind of criteria for best original song. And it can't just play over the closing credits. And it does. So like we could have Lady Gaga, Bradley Cooper, Troy Sivan all singing at the Oscars next February, which, you know, like, so RIP gay people, like that's going to be a big deal. but Boy Erased as a movie, I'm pretty intrigued by. The trailer is pretty effective. That again is based on a memoir similar to The Beautiful Boy, you know, with a bunch of powerhouse actors. Russell Crowe, Nicole Kidman play Lucas Hedges' parents. And you know, I feel like when a movie says we're going to open at Telluride, there's a degree of confidence there.
Yes.
You know, sometimes it doesn't work, like Battle of the Sexes, which I think was unfairly overlooked last year. But sometimes, you know, with Lady Bird or Moonlight, like Telluride premiere is like a really big launching pad.
I have an idea to save the Oscars. Lady Gaga could sing giving out the Best Cinematography Award.
Oh.
Like the Below the Line, just sing all the Below the Line Award.
Yeah. And now for a 30-minute presentation.
A musical tribute to then, art direction.
Then I would enjoy seeing those awards.
That would be pretty good.
The Troye Sivan song plays over the trailer if you guys want to like hear it. I don't know if it's available in full, but it's on the trailer.
Right.
So.
And it seems very pretty.
Yeah,
it
does.
Like a nice song.
It's lovely.
Well, speaking of... movies with, you know, singing in it or performance like Star Is Born. I will see Star Is Born on Friday morning, next Friday in Toronto. And then just a few hours later, I will see Vox Lux with Natalie Portman, which is written and directed by Brady Corbett, who made The Childhood of a Leader, another actor turned director. And we actually ran a first look of the movie on VF.com. It's just a long tracking shot of, we assume, Natalie Portman walking to the stage in some sort of, you know, glittery David Bowie-esque costume. So no one knows what the heck that movie is or what it's about or what the tone of it's going to be. Billed as a 21st century portrait, I believe. Anyway, it's premiering at Venice. It's very pretentious, very vague, but like, who the heck knows? Like, that could be something. And that's one of the few, I feel like, that no one had really been clocking until very recently. And those are often really fun movies.
Because
I feel like you had been clocking it, Richard. You should give yourself credit.
Well, I mean, like, for a couple of months, but, like, you know, I've been aware of Beale Street and Boy Erased for, like, a year, you know?
That's because you, well, you were aware of Vox Lux because you were a Jennifer Ely, like, fan website, right?
Well, right, so I'm the exactly.
The webmaster.
I'm the webmaster for, elyfreak.net.
And Richard, you had one other actor-director you wanted to get into as well, although not starring in his film, as far as I know.
Oh, yeah, Jonah Hill, mid-90s, which is a movie that, again, I didn't know anything, I didn't even know it existed until A24 very kind of just, like, you know, dropped a trailer for it without any warning a couple months ago. And it's this, you know, 90s, obviously, set L.A. skate, scuzzy punk kid thing that I guess maybe is loosely based on Jonah Hill's childhood, although he grew up in Brentwood, and, like, I don't know if that's, like, really if that's what he was like when he was a teenager. But anyway, that seems A24's kind of big play this fall. It'll world premiere at Toronto, and A24 actually has kind of a quiet slate this year. They don't have anything at Telluride.
Yeah, very oddly quiet.
So maybe this could be a thing, and I feel like that sort of confident trailer drop without any sort of warning indicates a confidence in the movie. But yeah, we'll see. I would have said a year ago, pre-Telluride, that, like, the Oscars will never like a teen movie, and then Lady Bird came along. That's much, you know, much more traditional kind of movie in a way, but than mid-90s looks to be. But
I was watching the trailer, I've watched it a couple times, the mid-90s trailer, and I mean, it definitely feels less approachable than Lady Bird, more maybe the vein of the Florida Project, you know, in terms of, like, the spareness and very, like, hardcore indie way that it feels. That being said, once again, if we're going to talk about actors that the Academy likes, Jonah Hill is one of them. And also, I've seen the 10 episodes of Maniac, his Netflix series that's dropping in September. And he, I think, is really incredible in it. So we want to talk about, like, TV boosting someone's profile. Like, if Jonah Hill has this
interesting,
has this great TV project. I loved it. I don't know. Maybe not everyone will. Like, you know, that might sort of get everyone warmed up on Jonah Hill and interested in seeing him in the director category.
Jonah Hill has also become a fashion icon, an unlikely fashion icon in the past, in the past year or so. The Scumbro look.
There was a whole day dedicated to him in Williamsburg at a bar a while ago.
Really?
He's taken off. So watch what Jonah Hill wears on red carpets at the very least.
He's having a moment. There's a Jonah Hill moment.
All I know about mid-90s is that I emailed Nicolette at A24 and I said, is there a party for that at Toronto? If there is, I want to go. Because that'll be a fun,
right? Take me with you. That will be fun. Like that. Yeah. I agree.
Please invite me.
And she said, well, I can't promise American Honey style, you know, debauchery, but, like, yes, there will be. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. People still talk about that.
That was a great party.
That was a good one.
Maybe let's close it out by all of us just kind of picking the thing, not necessarily that we want to see, but that we want to know about. Like, what is the biggest mystery for you at these festivals in the next 2 weeks that you're just dying to have an answer for?
Mine is really A Star Is Born. Like, is this thing going to be a huge juggernaut that's going to suck up a lot of oxygen and kind of take on Black Panther for, like, is this the big studio hit that could win Best Picture? Or is it going to be a kind of a kooky, you know, passion project for some movie stars who get to do whatever they want?
Yeah.
That's my big question.
It's good you mentioned Black Panther, because when I was writing this kind of preview piece and looking at what's coming, I was like, I still think Black Panther could win.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yes,
definitely. The sort of special category aside, the, you know, popular film or whatever. Like, I really think that Black Panther is still a front runner. And also, you know, the thing about Star Is Born is if it's really good, then Bradley Cooper is a big movie director.
Right.
You know, which is,
his Clint Eastwood plan. I mean, this guy knows what he's doing.
Well, because Clint Eastwood was supposed to do this movie. Clint Eastwood was supposed to do Star Is Born with Beyonce.
Yeah.
I got to
figure out who's my Clint Eastwood. You know, I think we all need to.
Who's going, like, to turn you into a powerhouse director? Yeah.
But just, like, whose career track do you just follow? It's kind of amazing. It does seem like that's what Bradley Cooper is doing.
Yeah.
It's just like, I want to get from here to there. And this guy did it. Let me, you know. I will pursue.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say that my biggest question mark, and it's kind of a boring one maybe, is, like, you know, as we've talked about ad nauseum on this podcast, like, is this when Netflix gets its Best Picture nomination?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have two seemingly very strong contenders, although two movies not set in the United States, one of which is not in English. The English one has no star. You know, neither of them have any big names in them. So those are impediments, I guess. But, like, you have a Paul Greengrass movie and an Alfonso Cuarón movie like in your hopper ready to go. Like,
yeah,
that feels like big. And if they can break through that barrier finally, that will be kind of precedent changing. You know, I think it'll, you know, that'll be a big deal.
I'm going to pick one that, Richard, I think you have talked me into being really excited for, which is The Front Runner, the movie in which Hugh Jackman plays Gary Hart, the kind of not the earliest political sex scandal, but kind of a major one before our current era. It's directed by Jason Reitman, who had Tully, which was so great. And I feel like, Richard, you floated the theory that this could be Hugh Jackman's best actor win, which at this point does feel like, oh, yeah, he should have won an Oscar by now. So I hope that it lives up to that hype, because I do think Hugh Jackman could be just really fun to have on an Oscar campaign. And coming off of his two huge hit last year, like, it all seems to be coming together for him, and I hope the movie can live up.
Well, I think their awards consultants had scored an early win when Gary Hart was one of the pallbearers for John McCain, and I was very impressed by their skill at negotiating.
That was some real
well done, guys.
Listening, I mean, I think that, like, Jackman, like, you know, well, now that Ethan Hawke has spoken out against Logan, like, maybe Logan is in jeopardy, but, like, but Greatest Showman made fucking $500 million. Like,
right.
Hugh Jackman had a huge 2017, and that lasted into early 2018, because Greatest Showman just kept playing and playing and playing. So, like,
I mean, Greatest Showman's still on YouTube, like, everywhere you look, so it's still playing somewhere.
So Hugh Jackman has momentum, and Jason Reitman has a little momentum off of Tully, which people liked out of Sundance. So I think that's a good one to keep an eye on, Katie. I think you're right.
I'll go with one we haven't talked about, which is The Old Man and the Gun, which is David Lowery's, like, this is the final performance from Robert Redford, allegedly. I never believe anyone when they say they're retiring.
But,
like, it's an interesting choice. You know, we love, or I think in this house, we love David Lowery, but it's, like, you know, it's not middle of the road necessarily as a choice for Robert Redford. And so I'm hoping it's actually something very, like, you know, something that penetrates a little deeper than some of the, like, this is Robert Redford being craggy and great in a few movies in the past few years, that I'm just sort of like, okay, fine. But maybe he'll go, like, really, really hard for his, like, last, allegedly, film. And maybe, you know, the Academy will want to give him that farewell. I don't know.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be really nice just watching him kind of flirt and have conversations with Sissy Spacek. Like, that's a good pairing.
Yeah, honestly.
I'm into that. You know, it is funny, though, that, like, that'll be at Telluride, I'm pretty sure, that Redford could potentially end his acting career up in the Rocky Mountains, but not at Sundance.
Like, how totally annoyed are, like, the Sundance programmers? They're like, dude,
yeah, come on. It was an easy layup, but yeah, I got teary at the first trailer for that. I think it looks great. And yes, Joanna, in this house, we like David Lowery.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase, every day. Then grow it at 4.50%. annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
Okay, so we're going to share the interview that Mike did with Monica Lewinsky and Greg Hahn, two Emmy nominees for the PSA that they made. Mike, you have been following, you've been friends with Monica for a long time. You've been following her anti-bullying work. So can you talk about, like, what brought her to making a PSA that got an Emmy nomination?
Yeah, you know, Monica and I randomly met 18 years ago, I think. We were volunteering, reading with kids up in East Harlem, and we've kept in touch through the years, and it's been amazing to see her in the last few years really find her voice and be able to. I think there was a long period of time where, you know, understandably, she didn't really want to be out in public that much, and in the wake of this Vanity Fair article that she wrote, she's been, I think, rediscovered in a way by a younger generation that kind of had never really questioned the treatment of her in our society, and suddenly was like, wait a minute, why did we blame the, you know, the young early 20s intern for the presidential scandal and take the side of all the people saying it was all her fault and she was an evil person. And so through that time, you know, she got treated very shabbily by a lot of people, basically everybody. And so I think she has a unique perspective on the question of bullying. I love that she has made that a cause. She's sought to kind of help other people deal with pain that she really knows about. She's kind of tireless thinking of ideas and talking to people. She's got a great network of people. And so she and Greg Hahn, who also joined the interview, he's at BBDO, the advertising agency. They put their heads together on a PSA that would really show the human cost of the kinds of abuse that people sort of dish out and take on the internet every day. And I think everybody who works in our business knows about this, especially the women. I mean, I think every woman on the internet just knows that there is a lot of horrible stuff that happens every day.
One of the things that she says in the interview, Mike, that I thought was interesting is that she realized that she had so rarely been insulted in person that most of the attacks that had come to her had been in the media, obviously, and then online through anonymous people. And what this PSA deals with is the, you know, what it looks like when online bullying happens in person. And it was just interesting to me because you think of Monica, like you said, as someone who's been treated so unfairly, but it's been by people who weren't willing to say it to her face, which just kind of says a lot about the kind of attacks she's endured. So it's interesting how she talks about that.
Yes, I think that insight really kind of drove this idea. So they're up for a Creative Arts Emmy. They will be given out at the Microsoft Theater in Los Angeles on September 8th. So I hope she wins. They have actually quite a good group of ads that they're up against. But this one's really, really powerful, and I hope everyone will watch it and enjoy the conversation. I am thrilled to be here today with Greg Hahn, the Chief Creative Officer of the ad agency BBDO. And my friend, the anti-bullying advocate and Vanity Fair contributing editor, Monica Lewinsky. Welcome, guys.
Hi.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here. And we're here on the occasion of you guys being nominated for an Emmy. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you.
So every year after Emmys, after Oscars, people go around calling, saying, where were you when you found out? So where were you, Monica Lewinsky, when you found out you got this Emmy nomination?
Well, I was in Australia, and it was about 5:30 in the morning, and I kind of, you know, got a sip of water, and then, of course, obviously checked my phone. And I had this email from Greg, and I open it, and it's like, congratulations, you know, you can now add Emmy nominee to your resume. And there was a link, and I was kind of half awake, and I thought, why is, like, did somebody who portrayed me in something get nominated? Is this, like, what kind of joke? And I open the link, and it's like Creative Arts Emmys and the commercials, and my heart's racing, and I'm scrolling, and it's like, oh my gosh, you know, we were nominated for a, can I say fucking
yeah,
Emmy?
Yeah, yeah.
So it was pretty insane. So a good way to start the day.
That's excellent. Yeah. In Australia. What'd you do the rest of the day in Australia?
Just, you know, did a jig.
Yeah. So, like,
told people Emmy. She was nominated for an Emmy.
Exactly.
Yeah. Emmy nominee.
I've gotten a lot of mileage out of that.
So, where are you going to put it if you win?
I'm going to put it on the hood of my car.
Okay. That's a great idea.
That would be rad. So this will be my first time at the Creative Arts Emmys.
Yeah.
Which is insane.
Right.
Really insane.
It's very cool. And let's talk about the piece itself, which is nominated. And this is actually quite a stacked field. There's a lot of really great things in here, but this is my favorite, just to be honest. Just I'm coming right out with it. But it's such a really fascinating, brilliant idea that you guys had in this piece of content. What do we call it? An ad? A PSA? A video?
All of the above.
Okay. At first, it's disturbing because I didn't realize that the people getting bullied are actors, right? And they're like crying.
Well, we debated that a lot. It's like, when do you reveal who's in on it and who's not?
I'm glad you revealed it because I was getting anxious.
Yeah,
and it relieved my anxiety when I saw that they weren't. But basically, just for those at home who haven't seen it, it is bullies who are actors bullying targets who are actors using real language from tweets, right? Verbatim.
Yeah.
What happens is this kind of reverse bystander effect. You think of the bystander effect being like everyone's just like, not my problem. And in actually all these cases, somebody says, hey, cut it out or get out of here or do you need a hug? But let me ask you something. Did that happen how often did that not happen? Because it's New York.
I think it happened a lot more than we could. A lot more than we could put in the film.
Right.
Really?
I think it was very unusual to have the scenarios where someone didn't do something. Even one of the parts that I really wanted in there, but we didn't have time, was there was actually in the scenario with the three young girls who are the schoolgirls who are targeting the other young schoolgirl. There was a guy who was on his bike and he kind of stopped and he didn't cross when he was supposed to cross and he kind of just hung out there and he didn't say anything. But when the two girls who were engaging in bullying behavior left, he went over to her to see if she was okay, the girl who was the target.
Yeah.
And that was really important, too, in terms of the message, because I think this top line note was about, you know, really getting people to rethink this online versus offline behavior. But the second is how valuable and important it is to step in, whether you step in while something's happening or after the fact.
Yeah.
There's a lot of value there so that someone feels seen and not alone. I was so grateful. Not surprised Brooklynites were like that empathetic, but it's gratifying.
It's really that third person in the conversation, the person that's not involved, but the person that steps in, that really brings in this idea that empathy is the thing that solves this, right?
Yeah.
And that it really brings the spotlight to the idea that your behavior online is completely unacceptable in real life.
Yeah.
So why do you behave like that on?
It's interesting. I had a Twitter exchange with someone. Somebody had written about they had just gotten into blocking behavior. Like at first they didn't want to do it. And I'm very pro blocking. Blocking is beautiful.
Hmm. I saw that hashtag on your tweet. Yeah.
Uh-huh. We have an emoji of it actually. What somebody responded in there was, you wouldn't stand in a room and let people yell awful things at you, which is true.
Yeah.
Unless it's your family. But
right. So,
but then you have other problems. But I think that kind of reflects that same sentiment here of just like, protect yourself and take care of yourself. You have every right, you know, to do that. So,
well, I'm glad that it turned out that way, because I feel like if you had done it in New Jersey, where I'm from, people might have just joined in and ganged up on the person.
Well, I think the culture would have you think that, right? You know, but people are actually a lot more caring than we New Yorkers tend to give them credit for. Actually, there's one guy in there. We had to stop a fight.
Yeah. I had just gotten on set. I was actually waiting on the corner until you guys were finished. And
it was the cafeteria, or the one where the bystanders,
red shirt guy.
Yeah, he's outside the window as two people are getting bullied inside the cafe. And actually, he almost got in a fight with the bully, and we had to put like a production assistant that got out, ran out immediately, and jumped between him and go, no.
This is the guy who's in the ad.
Yeah,
he's still in it. Get away from that window.
He's still in it.
Literally, it was like the arm was back, ready for the punch. I mean, it was.
That's a good Easter egg.
Yeah, no, we have it. It's good.
But it also, you know, I think it was also heartwarming, too, you know, that and representative of just how much we can care about other people who are strangers.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, and so how do we harness that more, particularly in the online world?
So tell me how this was shot. Was it all done in one day and in one borough?
It was all done in one day, different locations around Brooklyn. It was all in different parts of Brooklyn.
Different parts of Brooklyn.
Okay. It was hidden camera, and it was multiple cameras.
Wynn Bates was the director.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay.
Shout out to Wynn.
Yeah. We should mention everyone. It was a whole team of creative people and production people that put this thing together. But logistically, it was a little bit of a frightening prospect, because we didn't know who was going to intervene and what the response would be. So it was a bit of a risk there. But we got some pretty authentic stuff. Like I said, we almost got in a fight, so it's good.
and you were there, Monica.
I was there, not for the whole day, but I was there for a good portion of it. And in fact, actually, I think that just even from my own experiences of the stuff we saw, we talked the next day about trying to find ways to make some therapists even available for anybody, whether it was crew who had been involved or any of the actors. Because it was pretty, if you think about it, I mean, it was really, it was really intense. And I think it was challenging for the actors to engage in this kind of behavior that was anathema to everybody.
Well, it's, right, because you're asking somebody to sit there and have someone else say you should kill yourself because of some character trait that you may have.
We really made a point of using the comments verbatim. Like, we didn't have them improv at all, any of these things. So it was just all these comments were taken offline.
I mean, I know I teared up quite a few times that day, and I think there were several other people. I mean, it was, and I just, you know, I want to thank BBDO New York and Greg and his whole team. I mean, they really went above and beyond, not just sort of great creative, but everybody who worked on this and everybody in Dini's office, too. Everybody put their heart into this. And I think that is part of what has why it's connected with people is yeah. because there was so much care and authentic concern behind this. So,
and who had to chase everybody around with waivers?
one of the producers.
Shout out
producers.
That person.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
That had
they
to be like
amazing.
A cat herding operation.
Yeah.
Extraordinary.
And we also made sure that we blocked out a lot of the bystanders' faces. So we, yeah. you know.
That was really important to us of just, I think, and I think actually that's one of the other things that was interesting to me about the process too, was really how many layers of sensitivity we had to have with this also so yeah. that we wanted to be really responsible that if, you know, there was somebody who was sitting in the cafe who didn't respond, who didn't turn around, that they wouldn't then feel shamed right. by not, you know, by not yes. having their face blurred.
Yeah.
So there were just so many, I think, different layers of how we wanted to think about this. And
I think what's impressive is you thought through all those layers and yet the thing that comes across is very bold and fierce. Do you know what I mean? You can kind yeah. of gum something like that to death yeah. worrying about it, but you came through with something very potent.
It was a very fine line to walk on all those fronts.
Yeah,
but
I can imagine.
There were a couple discussions,
yeah.
but
yeah.
I think that was the benefit of the kind of the creative and the advocacy, like of yeah. our sides coming together.
We've been working with Monica for over a year now, right? Mm-hmm. It's started a little bit over a year. And she came to us with this great insight about bullying. She's been working on this cause for some time, and she wanted somebody to help her bring this to life and get it out there to the public. And just working back and forth with her over the few weeks that we spent in rooms and things together, we came upon this execution that is basically based on the idea of how people treat people differently in person than they do online.
Yeah.
When people get online, they're completely disassociated with that person, and they treat yeah. people honestly in ways that you would never have the courage or lack of grace to do in person. So I thought that was a really great place to start and a really great insight. And then we just decided what's the best way to kind of blow that out and get people to see it, and what's the best way to bring that to life in a video form. And that's kind of where we started.
Where Greg is being very generous is that I actually came with the insight and my own creative idea, yeah. which thankfully my ego let me put aside to go with the genius.
Well, can
creatives.
You tell us what it is? What your idea was?
Yeah, it was actually it wasn't a bad
Let's
idea.
It was a okay. thought starter.
It was a good insight. I'll give her that.
Thank you. It actually started in Central Park, where I saw a marathon happening, and I just noticed how interesting it was to see strangers cheering for strangers.
Yeah.
And so I thought, God, this is an incredible social behavior that we have, that we do this.
Yeah.
And yet, why don't we do that online? So my idea was like very literal, given where the idea started, which was sort of, you know, cuts of all this real life marathon footage of people cheering for strangers. And then you'd sort of have this marathon that you'd tape, and you'd kind of have people running, and someone would yell, you know, hey, look fat in those shorts, or go run in your own country,
right.
you know, so these kinds of things that we see online, but trying to communicate this idea of how strange it would be. We would never see something like that, you know, in marathon behavior in this kind of offline world. So they humored me for a little while, and then.
Well, I think it's. I appreciate you sharing the where it started, because I think a lot of people at home, you know, they may not be in this business and not understand how the creative process works, and often it is like, you know, you start with a great insight and you're like 75% of the way there at that point, and then
then we just built off it, because there's something really interesting in the insight of the behavior difference and how weird it would be to see that in real life,
right.
Right, so that's a great start.
But BBDO New York knocked it out of the park with the creative.
Yeah, so
I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt Greg, yeah, sorry. Yeah. But they have two ads nominated for the Emmys this year.
I did notice that.
Yeah,
Does that cause you problems?
I'm torn inside, no.
Hey!
I would be happy if either of the pieces won, but since we're here, I'm going to say I really hope this one wins.
Yeah, okay.
No, I do. Honestly, this one has a special. I was very close to this one. And, you know, regardless if it wins or not, I think it's done it's peace in the work in the world. So, you know, I'm happy about that.
I have a question for you. What do you think of this civility debate that's going on where people are saying, you know, you shouldn't kick Sarah Huckabee Sanders out of a restaurant or something like that? Do you feel like that's a separate conversation? Is that related?
That is a hard question, because I think that it depends on if it's disrupting the business, then maybe. But I tend to think that people should just be treated equally.
Right.
You know, I mean, as hard as it is at times to accept some things, it's everybody's right to be treated equally.
I would agree with that. I also think, too, that there are a lot of concentric circles of the kinds of social behavior we're seeing today. And so I think that maybe falls into one, the different ways that we see cyberbullying or online harassment, all of those kinds of things are other concentric circles. And I think this falls into one, that there's a way to express an opinion, and then there's ways which I think if you put yourself in the person's shoes, or you flip, usually these are political things, so if you flip the political ideology, I mean, and that kind of goes to so much of the hypocrisy we see, which is challenging now too.
Yeah, it's a bit of a slippery slope. If it's okay to kick her out, then who else, and then who else, and then suddenly it's you. You know,
So
I think the better call to arms is peace. You know,
yeah. I noticed on your Twitter one thing that you do that I would really struggle to have the greatness of mind to do, which is when someone sort of snarks at you and says, like, actually, whatever, you say, why don't you please tell me more about what you're thinking? I'd like to know your perspective. How hard is that? Does that come easily to you?
Well, you should see my drafts.
Yeah. I can imagine.
It's interestingly, I actually think that's where the distance on the internet helps sometimes, is that, you know, if you can find the ability to sort of just take a breath and take a step back. I recognize people come to a lot of conversations charged. It's really easy to misinterpret people's tone or intentions and what they're saying online. So, I think that when you sort of come at people with a more measured pace, it allows them to have more room to reconsider or to think about explaining. And really, I mean, isn't that the whole – that's when social media is at its best.
Right.
When people can engage in conversations and you can learn something. So you may not change your perspective, but to have a better understanding of a different perspective, I mean, that's really valuable, I think, in today's world. So,
well, it does seem like it disarms people when you
sometimes.
Do that, right? Okay, sometimes in the cases I've seen. And then, you know, like you say, like you add to the general understanding in the world rather than subtracting to it by getting into a flame war. So that's helpful.
I think Twitter or any of these social media sites should have like a pause button where if you reply, it says, are you sure you want to send this?
There's an amazing young woman, Trisha Prabhu, who made this software. And her software is called Rethink. And it's all about if you use certain words, it will pop up and a prompt will ask you, are you sure you want to use those words? Those are sometimes offensive or inflammatory, those sorts of things. And in her research, 95% of the people who had that pop up chose not to use those words.
Imagine if Jack just put that in, you know.
Hello, Jack.
Hello, Jack. Are you out there?
For you. So, I have lots of suggestions.
So can we talk a little bit about how you came to the bullying cause? I mean, you wrote that, you've written that there's a version of you that's out there that you can't really reclaim. But one thing that's interesting about this film is it ties into something you said, which is that you rarely had people say anything to your face in all those years, right?
Yeah. It was amazing when we were working on this and I realized that I could maybe count on one, maybe two hands, the amount of times that people have been rude to me to my face.
Yeah, you actually said that to us in the briefing, and that was like a huge light again that came off. It's like, if you stop and think about it, you're absolutely right. I don't know if anyone's ever insulted me to my face, but I get stuff online, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that when I thought of it in those terms, it was not only surprising to me, but I think it was surprising for a lot of other people to think, given, you know, kind of the public propertiness of my identity that was sort of out there for a long time. So I think it does speak to, you know, one of the things which is interesting is this is all still relatively new.
Yes.
You know, social media and our online behavior, particularly with social media. And I think that we just haven't really found a lot of the social norms yet or the social etiquette for all of this. And I hope we will eventually get there. And that's in one of the ways what I think the spot is, you know, aimed to doing is to getting people to be thinking about how does that work.
Well, and it's interesting because you've also written that you were basically the first kind of casualty of the internet, right? In the sense that the Drudge Report is part of what took your story and made it a global thing.
Right.
So you kind of were early to this crazy world
early.
That we're all kind of living in now.
Right, which I think is, you know, and that was a big part of what propelled me to where I am now today was really kind of what had happened with Tyler Clementi, and who was a college freshman who had been secretly webcam by his roommate being intimate with another man. And when that became public, he was so ridiculed that he tragically took his own life a few days later. And I talk about this in the TED Talk, but the experience of that was a real wake-up call for me, too, around this idea of, this is happening now to people who don't even make a mistake. You know, that this is not, you know, and this is happening more and more on social media, and we kind of don't have those conversations.
I remember when I was bullied, it was like, you know, either getting pushed around in person or like prank phone calls.
Right, right.
But these are public displays,
that's,
right, of humiliation.
That's what makes it feel so hurtful is that you feel like the whole world knows you're getting bullied.
Yeah.
And psychologically, too, there's no hard perimeter around those kinds of things. Like, if I make a faux pas right now, hopefully Daniel will edit it out.
Yes.
But I'm be, you know, embarrassed in front of everybody in the room. There's a border around that.
Yes.
But on the internet, you have no idea how many people, you know, and you're already now in a sensitive state. And it really, it's very easy to imagine the whole world is laughing at you.
Yeah.
And that can be really psychologically destructive.
So some of our listeners are young people who are really into film and probably sensitive, and they might be dealing with some of the stuff that, you know, that happens to young people. So what message do you have for them if they're being bullied, if they're experiencing this?
I think the first thing I'd say to anybody, you know, young or not so young, is to not suffer in silence.
Yeah.
So to tell someone. And I think that's really the most important first step. So, but second to that is kind of depending on your own personality, I think there's an element of trying to hold on to who you are in many ways. And I think that's where the importance of friends and family can come in, is kind of reflecting back to you your true self and keeping you moored to sort of who you know your true self to be. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of different techniques. And I think one of the things that and it's kind of demonstrated in the short film too, is that there are a lot of different ways or different paths to go about this. So, you know, and what works for one person may not work for someone else. So be open to this idea of, I think, trying to find different things. If you try one solution and it doesn't seem to work for you, look for something else. There's a lot out there. There are a lot of people who are working to try to shift this culture.
One thing through this, we're just trying to show people is that they're not alone. It happens.
Yeah.
It happens to a lot of the fact that this has become so, you know, quote unquote viral, just shows you that people are identifying with it. And so many people do suffer in silence. But I think the more we bring this out to light and show that, you know, this is something that happens to everybody, and it's something you can share. And if you're experiencing that, then, you know, the best thing to do is talk to somebody if you're feeling alone.
We talk about the people being bullied and how to make them feel less alone. What about the bullies? Like, do they change when they see this? Are they shamed at all?
Well, that was a big part of the audience was to make people reconsider. And I don't think, you know, the hardcore bullies are going to change that much. But to people, 90% of the people, quote unquote, bullies are just making rude comments and they don't know how hurtful they are. I think it will definitely stop. That kind of thing.
I think it makes people rethink.
Yeah.
But I also think, too, that there's, and this is not true in every case, but I do think that there are a large number of people who engage in this kind of disruptive behavior and harmful behavior because they themselves are hurting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I think that there's a – and oftentimes they themselves have been bullied. Mm-hmm. So it might be because of reasons at home or in other experiences. So I think that there's – you know, this is a – people often ask me, like, what are the three things we can do to fix this? And it's like, this is a really complex morass of a problem. Yeah. That, and I think that the people who engage in bullying behavior are very much a part of that conversation. So yeah. I hope they watch this PSA, and I hope they, you know, think about how they can be just a little bit better. I think for me, the most rewarding thing that's come from this was we heard that a teacher had shown the short film in her class, and at the end of the school year when they sort of wrote out their the questionnaire from the year, a lot of them wrote seeing this film was one of the most memorable moments of their year.
Wow.
Which is just, I mean, you kind of can't ask mm-hmm. for anything more rewarding.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And really thinking about the far reach that we had with this too, and that it was not only kind of trending on YouTube, but also had across all these different platforms, you know, 27 million views.
27 million?
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Right.
That's a lot of people.
And I've incorporated it into my talk, and it's, first it's amazing to me because I've now seen this, you know, probably a bajillion times.
Yeah.
And I tear up every time. But it's also something that people come up to me after the talks to really comment on, and I can see people wiping away tears in the audience. So it's just, I think what it says to all of us in a big way is that there's a lot of pain out there right now from this. And I think even for maybe our vintage, that there's sort of this pain from when we were younger, when we went through these things, and there really weren't conversations around them. And I think we carry that with us for a long time. So I hope it helps heal people.
All right. Well, thanks so much for coming by, and I really appreciate
it.
It's always great to see you, and good luck.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks. Yeah,
thanks, guys.
Thank you.
That does it for this week's Little Gold Men. Thank you for listening. Next week, we're going to catch up with Richard and Mike about what they saw at Telluride. So please stick with us. It's a great time to tell other people to listen to the show. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and leave a review. It really helps. You can find us all on VanityFair.com. Writing about all of these movies, you can find Richard's preview. And you can also find the Monica Lewinsky PSA on VF.com as well. You can find us all on Twitter at Little Gold Men. And on our own, I'm at Katie Rich. Mike?
Mike_Hogan.
And Richard?
Riot Laws.
And Joanna.
Joe wrote this.
This episode was edited and produced by Danielle Roth, and this week's award for the best description of having all four of us back on the show goes to Mike Hogan.
Yet normal people are enjoying the weirdness of it.
The Run for Revogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that.
We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Winter OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.